This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
Conservatives always have criticized the media. Liberal media bias goes back so far. Candidates, presidents have criticized the press. Richard Nixon did it. Ronald Reagan did it. The Bush presidents did it. This is an old problem.
We're joined by John J. Miller. He is director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College, also founder and executive director of the College Fix, which we'll talk about in a moment. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Scott.
Wrote a piece recently. Find it at AmericanHabits.org, a call for more conservative minds in media. People might look and say, well, yeah, Daily Caller and National Review, and there's a lot of sites on the right that feature conservatives writing. So what do you mean? What's missing? Where are conservatives missing in the media?
Conservatives always have complained about liberal dominance of the media, liberal media bias. This is a generational problem. This goes back to the 50s and the 60s. Barry Goldwater complained about it. So did Ronald Reagan. This is an old problem for conservatives, the fact that liberals seem to dominate the press. And you're right. There are a lot of new-ish websites, news websites that present conservative viewpoints and so forth, but still liberals dominate the media, and this has been true for a long time, and the question is why. And I think at the root of it is the fundamental problem that not enough conservatives go into the profession. They don't choose journalism as a career path, and until they do, this will remain a problem.
Part of the piece is examining why that might be. You say that there's a fear, perhaps, when you fail in media, you fail in public in front of a lot of people. And there's also these social media storms that largely tend to target those on the right and not those on the left. Are those two aspects discouraging conservatives from perhaps pursuing a career in media?
Well, journalism isn't for everybody, and you're right. One of the challenges of journalism is that if you make a mistake, if you fail in public. Everybody gets to see, and there are not a lot of professions where that's true. You know, sports, it's true. But there's probably a lot of bad lawyering that goes on in America, a lot of bad doctoring that goes on in America, and yet that's often not notice. Journalism is a public profession in a lot of ways. And if you make a mistake, you will hear about it, and never more so than now because of social media and so forth. And perhaps conservatives face a bigger burden here. But that's a quality that I think affects everybody. This problem. If a liberal fails in the media, they'll hear about it as well. And if they get a fact wrong, if their newspaper has to print a correction, that's embarrassing no matter what are your politics. So these are reasons why I think just generally why people might not choose journalism as a career path. Conservatives will face some special challenges, and we should maybe step back and say, you know, the idea that different professions would be dominated by people with different kinds of political persuasions is really kind of an ordinary thing. It shouldn't surprise us. In fact, there's survey data that suggests that most police officers are Republicans and most social workers are Democrats. And of course, right? I mean, someone who goes into social work is probably the kind of person who tends to vote Democrat. That shouldn't surprise us. Why is it that most journalists are liberal? Again, survey data proves this. Why is that the case? This is a bit of a head scratcher for me, because as a conservative who chose journalism, I love the field. I can't imagine a life without it. Why is this not a more appealing to conservatives? I have one hypothesis would be that conservatives, maybe small C conservatives, are satisfied with the way things are in mm-hmm. general. They're less likely to challenge authority. They're less likely to challenge current conventions and so forth. And of course, journalism requires a kind of questioning stance, a kind of skepticism, even an adversarial relationship with sources, with power, and so forth. Does that attract more liberals? Maybe, as I say, it's a hypothesis. There are probably other factors as well, but the fact remains that the profession is dominated by liberals, and until more conservatives choose to go into the profession, liberals will dominate it.
We're going on nearly a decade now of Donald Trump being highly critical of the media, some specific media members, but also the media writ large. And there's also now been a decade of conservatives seeing coverage of President Trump and being dissatisfied with the coverage and perhaps dispirited by Donald Trump's rhetoric about the media, toward the media. That's a long time. That's a decade now. And for young conservatives thinking about media, how influenced are they by what the leading figure of the party, Republican Party, says about the media?
That's an important factor, I think. And I will say conservatives always have criticized the media. Liberal media bias goes back so far. Candidates, presidents have criticized the press. Richard Nixon did it. Ronald Reagan did it. The Bush presidents did it. This is an old problem, and criticisms of the press are out there. What's new with Donald Trump? He was more aggressive about it. He was maybe better at it in certain ways. You know, the idea of fake news. I mean, what a great slogan that is to define a concept that's a problem and that distorts the way we gather news and information and so forth. Often, though, when Trump has done it, he's made it personal, and he's veered towards suggesting journalism is not a noble profession, that it is unworthy of talent and so forth. And, you know, you might say this is a comedy routine. He's kind of funny when he does this. And a lot of times he's right that there's a lot of bad journalism that has surrounded his candidacy, that has surrounded his time in office, really, full of fake news journalism. He's correct about so much of that. On the other hand, there's been an edge to it sometimes that has dissuaded young people from going in. Young conservatives who might have great careers in the media, who might help America by going into the media, are perhaps turned off because of some of the things he's said. So that's a kind of additional challenge here and a more recent one.
One final question for John J. Miller. We have the privilege of working with Hillsdale College students inside our journalism department. You also work with outside students and journalists at the College Fix. The affirmative case for why conservatives do choose to head into journalism as a career. What do students say? Why do they want to pursue a journalism career?
Well, so many of them are they like writing. They're interested in writing. People who start out, you love to read books. That leads to writing. A lot of those are drawn into it. But I think fundamentally, you want to be a curious person. You want to be curious about the world, interested in asking questions and going and finding people with great experiences and learning from them, hearing their stories and then retelling their stories. You have to have a love of curiosity, but also storytelling and conveying that information and doing it through writing. Of course, you can do it through radio, through talking, also presenting on video, on television, and that sort of thing. And so the students who are interested in this, they often discover a love for it that they didn't know they had. They try it out and they find it agreeable. So the first step is just persuade them. Why don't you try to do a story or two for the campus newspaper? And that's often the thing that turns them on to the idea. They've just got to try it out. But those who come to Hillsdale. Many who work through the College Fix have gone on to flourishing careers. They're working at the Wall Street Journal editorial page. They're in the White House briefing room today. They're also working at community newspapers, city metropolitan newspapers, reporting on what's happening in the auto industry, for example, or what's going on in the legislature in Tennessee and so forth, and just reporting the news. And what's different about what they do, it's not that they wake up every morning and think about, you know, how can I distort the news in a conservative way today? What they're doing, though, is they're thinking a little bit differently about how to report the news. What are the questions I should ask? What is the news? What are the stories I should bring to the attention of our readers? Just having this additional perspective is so important. And the more conservatives go into it, the better our journalism will be.
John J. Miller is director of the Dow Journalism Program at Hillsdale College, founder and executive director of the College Fix. You can find his piece at AmericanHabits.org, a call for more conservative minds in media. John, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott.
Up next, Jeremy Carl, senior fellow with the Claremont Institute. His recent book, The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Cascade Curations in downtown Reading is a unique destination location. Cascade Curations is a vibrant hub celebrating the creativity and talent of local artists, musicians, and designers. Clothing racks are stocked with upcycled and upscale thrift, as well as new clothing unlike anywhere else. Whether you're seeking beautiful artwork to adorn your home, new music to inspire you, or musical instruments and gear to play, Cascade Curations is a must-visit spot to immerse yourself in Reading's thriving arts and culture scene, located in the Foundry Square next to the Dip.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Auto Body. Big box store body shops to come to our area. They contract with as many insurance companies as possible. They provide discounts for these referrals. This allows the insurance company to dictate the parts and repair process to ensure the lowest cost of repairs as possible. This is not in your best interest for your expensive investments. At Coachmaster, we work for our customer, not the insurance company. We have no obligation to cut parts prices or use inferior parts. We follow strict manufacturer repair guidelines. It's your choice and your choice alone where you choose to have your vehicle repaired. Coachmaster was established in Reading in 1969 and doing quality repairs in Reading for over 55 years. Coachmaster has proven to be your best choice for collision repair. And yes, it is your choice. Our friendly service and quality repairs will have you referring all your friends and family. And remember, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Remember Coachmaster on Eastside Road. Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
The Reading Sash Alliance is dedicated to making sewing, fashion, and business education accessible for everyone. We are a nonprofit located at 1616 Market Street. Get ready for November 9th as we present Artisan Avenue, The Craft of Fashion. Experience a runway of a blend of couture fashion to wearable art. Tickets will be available starting October 1st on our website at readingfashionalliance.org. Our call for fashion designers for Artisan Avenue is open until August 31st. Visit our website for more information on how to enter into the fashion show.
Every day, your life is filled with choices. And when a health crisis happens, you need to be prepared to choose the best healthcare partner. That's when Shasta Regional Medical Center is there to answer the call above the rest. Ranked best in Reading and in the nation for patient safety and clinical excellence, you can be confident that when you choose Shasta, you are choosing superior care, safety, and excellence for you and your family. Choose Shasta at ShastaRegional.com.
Hey, Reading, take an inflation vacation with Black Bear Diner's 7 new weekday dinner deals starting at just $9.99. Tasty fish tacos, creamy fettuccine carbonara, steak and fries, a crispy chicken dinner, beef stroganoff, and more. Serve Monday through Friday after 4 p.m. Escape inflation's grip on your wallet and set the table tonight with good old-fashioned family food at your friendly Black Bear Diner in Reading on Hilltop Drive.
Black Bear Diner.
This is Carl Bott and Ted Leidy. We want to invite you to our new show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right, even cooking sometimes.
Even cooking sometimes. People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up, fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
You. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We welcome our new radio affiliate and listeners in Staunton, Virginia on WTON, 1240 AM, 101.1 FM, and 98.9 FM in Northwestern Virginia. Thank you for listening to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We're joined by Jeremy Carl. He is senior fellow at the Claremont Institute. You can find him on X at Real Jeremy Carl, and his new book is The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on, Scott.
You mentioned at the beginning of the introduction to this book that the argument here runs against approved narratives, which might be a bit of an understatement, I suppose, when looking at the title. Why does this need to be framed in this way? Why does this argument need to be framed in this way?
Well, I think it's important because I think there's a lot of euphemism. There's a lot of discomfort. You'll see a lot of talk on the right about critical race theory or wokeness, and I mean, and both of those things can sometimes encompass a slightly larger group of issues than what I'm talking about in the book. But frequently, it's just a euphemism for not being willing to say that currently we have a racist and discriminatory system which is harming white Americans. And I think a lot of even conservative white Americans are kind of uncomfortable with using that type of language. But I think if you can't talk about something, then you can't really begin to address it in a meaningful way either.
The phrase that pops up through the book, disparate impact. We talked with Heather McDonald about that a while back here on the show. And you quote someone in the book saying disparate impact is how the state enforces anti-white discrimination. So what is disparate impact and how does it work?
Sure. Disparate impact is a doctrine that comes from the Supreme Court case called Griggs versus Duke Power that was decided in 1971. It was even for those who are not critical of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, I think people would say it was something that kind of really went against the text of the act. But basically, to oversimplify, what it says is if you have a kind of population group and you kind of have an employment process of some sort or a hiring process and you kind of run that group through the process and you get, you know, sort of numbers by race at the end of that process that are very different than the kind of reference population, then it's seen to have a disparate impact against that group presumptively, and it can be therefore ruled illegal. And there is all sorts of mischief that can be done under this doctrine. And I think the key thing to kind of emphasize here, there does not need to be any shown intent to discriminate by any sort of category. It's just that the mere outcome, if it's not perfectly sort of aligned by group, can put you at legal risk.
Judicial review, you say, is also the way that this is enforced. The enforcers, judicial review. The argument is if the courts do lack the preferred ethnic composition, then they might not be legitimate. If you aren't the right race, you're right, you can't arbitrate against race or about race. Why is the left so focused on the judicial system, the Supreme Court? Why is that such a flashpoint in today's discussions?
Well, I think the real reason that the court in particular has become such a flashpoint is it's the one type of the form of government that the left doesn't effectively really control. I think functionally, whether or not they kind of control it nominally, they frequently end up through the deep state or administrative state controlling both the executive branch and the legislative branch, whether or not they are nominally in power. It's only kind of a question of degree. The judicial branch is really the only branch that has some independence from that. And therefore, the left has kind of waged a full-on war against the judicial branch, including talking about things like packing the court that were far too radical even for Franklin Roosevelt to get through the Congress when he had a 3-1 legislative majority in the 1930s.
The book then goes chapter by chapter into many different categories, but let's sort of paint with a broad brush here as we begin. Anti-white racism, where is it most obvious? Where would you point and say, well, clearly, here's what I'm talking about throughout the unprotected class?
Sure. Well, I think the kind of most obvious ways that we're seeing it now are in things like hiring or in affirmative action in universities. So sort of the whole affirmative action process. Now, again, if you look at the university context significantly, the Supreme Court has just overturned that. But I'm sort of skeptical, unfortunately, that that's going to really mean nearly as much as proponents might think on the ground. California has twice outlawed affirmative action at the ballot box in its universities. And if you look at the actual admissions processes within the universities, they basically figure out ways to just get around it and ignore it. And I'm worried that'll happen there. But you have the same sort of thing in hiring processes. You see this really visibly. But there are also some sort of more esoteric ways that this is going on. I kind of document even there was COVID treatment prioritization in some cases that happened by race. So it's really, in some ways, it's very, very visible and obvious. And then in other areas, like the entertainment industry, in my entertainment chapter, some of it's obvious, but some of it's a lot more subtle and subliminal.
The chapter on There Goes the Neighborhood was interesting to me. There's a lot of discussion, talk about white flight from neighborhoods. You introduced a term I don't think I had heard before, blockbusting. What is that, and how does it fit into your themes in the unprotected class?
Sure. So I have probably kind of the most subversive narrative to the consensus in this book is my chapter on real estate and kind of all that, because I sort of argued that effectively white flight was the only form of ethnic cleansing in which the primary victims were blamed. And I think that really happened for a variety of reasons, one of which being that the kind of working and middle class people who were most affected by white flight, you know, they didn't have great access to universities and publishers and other places where these stories were told, and the people who were kind of telling these stories were not particularly sympathetic to them. But blockbusting was a sort of way that unscrupulous real estate speculators would come in and convince people that a big demographic transition was about to happen in their neighborhood. And if they didn't leave, they were going to kind of be the last white family on the block, and they better sell now for an amount far under the market value, or they were kind of at risk. And this was actually used to great effectiveness to kind of turn over many, many neighborhoods by real estate speculators. And I kind of document in the book the degree to which this really kind of devastated a lot of white middle and working class families. And I also go through the point of saying that, and this is kind of the part of the narrative the left really doesn't want you to say, it was not because of course there were actual just racists who didn't want to live next to somebody who looked differently from them. But in many cases, that wasn't the case. You know, people were interested in trying to make it work with new neighborhoods. They didn't want to leave places where they'd been established as families for decades or in some cases, even centuries. But what often happened with racial neighborhood turnover is things became very unsafe. Schools collapsed, everything else. And finally, it simply became untenable for a lot of people to leave and so or to stay. And so they left.
Back in a moment, we'll continue our conversation with Jeremy Carl. His recent book, The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Blue skies and sunny days are here, and so is summer travel. That's why Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market and Eureka Way in downtown Reading invites you to stop by and enjoy their all-cloth car wash, where they take the time to pre-wash and hand-scrub your car or truck, where they work hard to remove the bugs, just in case your vehicle is a summer bug magnet. Quick and Clean is fast, convenient, and has a towel-dry exit. Quick and Clean at the corner of Market and Eureka Way in downtown Reading.
Dinosaurs have taken over Turtle Bay Museum with Expedition Dinosaur, Rise of the Mammals. Open now through September 2nd, featuring large-scale animatronics and life-size models of dinosaurs, hands-on activities, and more. Journey back in time and explore the end of dinosaur reign in this highly interactive and educational exhibition from Stage 9 Exhibits. Expedition Dinosaur, Rise of the Mammals, on display now at Turtle Bay Museum. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
30 years ago, Simpson University arrived in Redding with a promise to serve the North State. Warmly welcomed by this far Northern California community, we forged lasting partnerships, serving our neighbors locally as well as globally. Building on our promise, Simpson University now offers over 20 degree programs. Our promise to be the gateway to world service begins in our backyard. Learn more about Redding's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
North Valley Distributing at 3081 Crossroads Drive in Reading is a proud sponsor of Reading Colt 45's baseball. North Valley Distributing is a major supplier of electrical and electronic products for the industrial and construction markets, featuring services with concentration in industrial automation, lighting, distribution, controls, data communication, solar, and energy solutions. North Valley Distributing, a proud sponsor of Reading Colt 45's baseball. Call 530-222-1500. That's 530-222-1500.
Come celebrate the 40th anniversary of the veteran-owned sandwichery at 1341 Tehama Street in downtown Reading. This mom-and-pop restaurant has been serving up delicious, quick, and fresh, made-to-order sandwiches with generous portions at a great price for 40 years. Enjoy a club sandwich, pastrami corned beef, a Californian with turkey, avocado, and cheese, an egg salad sandwich, roast beef, chicken salad, and I'm getting hungry just thinking about it. They also have vegetarian sandwiches and much more. Plus, hot dogs and homemade soups, potato salad, and big bakery-style cookies. Sandwichery is also a destination featuring unique World War II decor with inside dining and outside shaded patio seating. Sandwichery, celebrating their 40th anniversary this July. Open Monday through Friday from 10 to 2 at 1341 Tehama Street in downtown Reading. Sandwichery, dine in or take out. Call 530-246-2020. That's 530-246-2020.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
Good morning, Reading. This is Rick Hughes, host of The Flatline. Heard every Sunday morning on KCNR 96.5 FM at 7 a.m. in the morning. Just want you to know that God has given us two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. And success in life depends on which one you use. It's heads you win and tails you lose. Come join me on The Flatline and learn about God's tremendous problem-solving device. 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, 96.5 FM, KCNR.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We've been talking with Jeremy Carl, senior fellow at the Claremont Institute. His recent book, The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. Jeremy, on the topic of illegal immigration, which of course is such a prominent discussion happening right now, you write in that chapter about the mass growth of illegal immigrants and how they're represented in the census. I don't know if people understand how that happens and how it's led to the creation of what is called rotten boroughs. How is that affecting America in representation and then, you know, translating over into the government as well?
Sure. So I think the thing to understand here is that, and the term rotten boroughs is actually something I'm borrowing from former way that things were done in England before they had electoral reform laws, I believe in the 19th century, where you had electoral districts of vastly different populations all kind of giving the same level of representation. Well, today we have that same thing going on in districts where you have a ton of illegal aliens, and these are particularly almost universally Democratic-leaning districts, particularly urban districts. you have each of those illegal aliens being counted in the same way for census apportionment as somebody who's here legally. So if you have a district with 300,000 citizens and 400,000 illegal aliens, I mean, this would be sort of an extreme case. I mean, that wouldn't really quite work like that, but it would be counted the same way as 700,000 citizens and no illegal aliens in some other district. And so what you wind up with is the citizens in the district that has a lot of illegal aliens, or the state that has a lot of illegal aliens, are benefiting. They're benefiting from more power for their vote, more congressional representation, precisely because they are allowing lawlessness. And I'd add, there's even kind of intermediate cases where you have people who may be lawfully present, but who are not citizens, who can't vote. And I think you can argue that for apportionment purposes, you should really only be counting citizens. But the left has abused this, and it gives them several additional congressmen probably every year. And in addition to that, a lot of money is distributed to places by census formula. So places that have tons of illegal aliens are getting a lot more money. They're being, again, incentivized to engage in this sort of illegal behavior.
The chapter Unhealthy Disrespect on Healthcare, and this works in coordination with recent stories on UCLA and the UCLA Medical School. How is anti-white racism affecting doctors and perhaps your health and my health in the future?
Yeah, well, I mean, I certainly will not, I won't go to a doctor under 40 years old at this point, because I just don't trust the process over the last 15 years. And I'm married to a physician who has been used to select physicians. And we saw this, as you noted, at UCLA, where some investigative reporting by Aaron Sabarium has shown kind of vastly lowered standards being put in for some minority physicians in terms of admissions. But then it also goes to like what they're being taught in these schools about health. You see that kind of popping up in kind of doctors, physician views on so-called transgender care. So essentially you have underqualified students coming into medical schools. They're being taught in many cases dangerous nonsense, particularly with respect to race. And that is ultimately rebounding to have lower care. And just a small example of this, and I document this in the book, the American Heart Association only was kind of dragged kicking and screaming to correctly identify that people of South Asian descent with sort of smaller waists, relatively speaking, were at higher risk than, say, white Americans or Americans of other ethnic backgrounds who had a slightly larger waistline in terms of having heart disease. But because they were sort of forbidden in their own minds from kind of acknowledging any sort of reality around race, a lot of people who were at higher risk were not informed that they were of higher risk, because this was breaking some sort of politically correct doctrine. So that's kind of what we're up against.
Jeremy Carl with us. His book, The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. We've heard the other side about white privilege and sort of having an automatic lead in life if you are white. How would you describe the harm that is occurring due to the anti-white racism you describe inside the unprotected class?
Yeah, and I'd add, I mean, the people using that, it's the only reason that you're able to actually say that is because it doesn't exist anymore. At a time, and there absolutely were historical times, of course, in America in which it was a privilege to be white or a benefit, people were desperately trying to identify as white. Mm-hmm. In a variety of cases, you even had in the early 20th century Indian Americans going before the Supreme Court arguing that they were sort of the original Aryans and therefore should be classed as white. I mean, that's what a white supremacy or a white privilege environment looks like. Today, you have the exact opposite, where if you are legally identified as white, but you can identify yourself as some other way, Hispanic, Native American, whatever, you do that on the census and elsewhere because you know that a lot of benefits will accrue to you mm-hmm. by doing that in employment, in university admissions, et cetera.
The last chapter, the end game, talking about reparations and expropriation, if I can quote you, the end game, to create an intellectual and cultural environment to justify the expropriation of land, property, and other wealth from whites, while at the same time creating a system in which anti-white employment practices exist and there is legal discrimination. All that sounds intensely anti-American, Jeremy. How would a system like that, as you say, tear America apart?
Well, I think it's just, I mean, any time if you look at the history of multiracial democracies, particularly where you have folks fighting over ethnic spoils, it doesn't typically end very well. And so a lot of times it ends in violence. And obviously that's something that we would like to avoid at any and all costs. And so, again, I've really written this book, and certainly with white people in mind, but not just for white people, because I argue in the book that really we kind of all have a role to play here in heading off this type of direction that we're really currently barreling toward, because it's not going to work for anybody. And it goes directly against the ideal that we have in America of trying to treat people by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin.
And in part of the recommendations toward the end of the book, embrace lawfare versus the anti-white establishment. Lawfare is a, I think, relatively recent term. We've heard much more in the past 12 months, 18 months or so. How can entering the court system and using those courts sort of against those who are already leveraging the courts for their ends work out in the end?
Right. Well, I think it's an imperfect solution and it's a partial solution, but it is a solution. I mean, first of all, there's a lot of things that are going on today that are even separate from the question of whether we should be changing our civil rights laws. And I think we should. But even under the current civil rights laws, there's a lot of anti-white things that are going on that are just plainly and facially illegal and they haven't been challenged. And then when you get groups like America First Legal coming in to challenge them, what you see is that often they're just folding before even going to court because they realize they're not going to have a good legal case, or even if they think they have some legal case, they're worried they're going to lose and set a precedent. So basically we can roll some of this back through aggressive lawfare in the courts. Unfortunately, Biden has appointed, as I talk about in my book, a number of really radical judges. So we're going to have to deal with some of these crazy judges on the left. But at least at this point, if we fight some of this in the courts, we can even the playing field and get rid of some of the most egregious abuses that are coming out of the current system.
Jeremy Carl, senior fellow at the Claremont Institute. You can find him on X at Real Jeremy Carl, and his new book, The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks so much for having me, Scott. It was a pleasure to be on.
Up next, we're joined by Dr. Dutton Carney from Hillsdale's English Department as we continue our series on James Joyce. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Are you craving a delicious pizza at a great price? Look no further than Charlu's Tap House. Charlu's Tap House is bringing back their incredible pizza deal. Every Tuesday from 4 p.m. until close, you can enjoy half off on your second pizza. That's right, buy one of any size and get the second one half off. This offer is only available for dine-in. So gather your friends and family and head over to Charlu's Tap House. The famous meal deal is backed by popular demand. For just $29.95, you can choose between a medium two-topping pizza or a large plate of spaghetti with two mouth-watering meatballs. You have the option to indulge in a large house or Caesar salad. It's a complete feast at an unbeatable price. Charlu's Tap House is the place to be every day of the week from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. Enjoy a refreshing drink from our beer wall and get a fantastic 25% off during happy hour. Don't miss out on these incredible offers. Visit Charlu's Tap House today and savor the flavors you love at the prices that can't be beaten.
Hi,
Hi, this is Linda Fott. Join me for the first Thursday of every month at 6 p.m. for my show, North State Now. In this one-hour show, we cover what's happening in the music scene, theater, food, and arts. We get in-depth interviews with local business owners, musicians, actors, and authors. Listen in, tune in, call in, participate. Win tickets to concerts and theater productions. It's a lot of fun, and believe me, it keeps us going. Join me, your host, Linda Bott, or North State Now, the first Thursday, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. Also streaming at KCNR1460.com.
FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio. Find out what's happening in our town, our community, and our nation. That's Monday through Friday, 7 to 9 AM, right here on KCNR, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio. Miss a day, miss a lot.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wing Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill we all have to pay? The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new edition of the program. Go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu, click the subscribe tab, and enter your email address. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Dr. Dutton Carney. He is Associate Professor of English at Hillsdale College. Dr. Carney, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Continuing our series on James Joyce and his works. Last time we talked Doubleters, this collection of short stories, and this time we discuss Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. Set this up for us. Who are the important characters, one of the storylines we should know about this book?
Well, we need to know Stephen Dedalus, who is the artist as a young man, and a very young man. The book is written in five sections, parts, chapters, however you want to put it. And it opens with a nursery rhyme that Stephen would hear as a young boy. And it ends with him writing in his diary what his plans are. So the main characters would be, especially early on, and this would be understandable, would be his family. Mm-hmm. So definitely his father, Simon, who was modeled on his father, Joyce's father, and then friends that he meets in school. So one of his friends is Cranley, and he meets him, say, in maybe part five, and he'd already been a classmate with him. But then in the middle of Portrait, which is really interesting, is that Stephen has this religious awakening, and he does everything that and he's going to a religious school. He does everything that the people are asking him to do. And so it looks like, oh, well, clearly he's going to enter the priesthood. And so you have different figures, but not a lot of deep friendships. And it seems like at the end, he even breaks with his good friend Cranley.
Are we to understand our main character here, Stephen, as simply a stand-in for Joyce himself?
I don't think simply, but he's definitely a stand-in. I mean, Joyce is all over the place here. That when you read about Simon Dedalus and you read some of the anecdotes of Joyce's own father, or when Stephen goes to grade school, it's the same school that Joyce went to. You have a description of the streets. When I was in Dublin for Jonathan Swift's 350th anniversary, one thing that I did is that I took the route that that Leopold Bloom and then eventually Stephen Dedalus take all the way through Dublin, and that school is still there. One thing that's really interesting is that Stephen, while his father is trying to secure a scholarship for him, looks at one of the old desks and his father has carved his name into the desk, and mm-hmm. so you have that kind of continuity, and those things happened indeed.
How does Joyce create a sense of the mood throughout this novel?
What he does is that he keeps shifting narration. You get a different kind of perspective. I mean, like in similar way in Dubliners, where you have the very first stories that are about adolescence and children, and the later stories in more mature individuals, and the narrative technique changes. The same sort of thing happens here, where you understand the world through song, through nursery rhyme, and then you start to understand the world through what you're told. I mean, we could reduce it to a sequence of birth, school, work, death, but what happens in each of those instances is that those phases of life is that we understand the world in a different way, and we participate more and more in the world. And so what's interesting is that at the very beginning of the novel, he's having nursery rhymes said to him, and at the very end of the novel, he is going to forge the smithy of his race. He's going to create it all himself.
Talking with Dr. Dutton Carney, Associate Professor of English here at Hillsdale College, about Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, the James Joyce book. What does this work tell us about the way in which identity arises and what shapes us and makes us the way that we are?
I would have to say the intermediary institutions that we encounter in our lives. In Dubliners, all those institutions are dead or dying or misdirecting people toward their proper end. In Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, at least you get to see those institutions from the inside out. So you get mm-hmm. to see him as a student. And then really what's interesting is that when he has this religious awakening and decides to go all in on whatever the church teaches, and he serves at mass, he is part of a sodality, he's always praying. One thing that's kind of interesting is that if you read the sermon from the main priest, and this is what brings Stephen kind of to his knees, it's full of Jansenism, and Jansenism is this extraordinarily scrupulous approach to religion. I guess we'd call it something like Pharisaism. And so Stephen, when he rejects the church, he's rejecting it for the right reasons. He throws the baby out with the bathwater. And so that's one thing that's really interesting is that I think with every section and the way that Joyce views the world and how Joyce views it through Stephen, is that every phase of our life we start all over again,
mm-hmm.
and so we don't ignore tradition, but we're not going to let it dictate, you know, the every single phase of the next phase.
How does our main character here, Stephen, how does he come to reject both the completely sinful lifestyle and then, as you were just talking about, this completely devout lifestyle?
Right. At the end of one of the sections, he spends time with a prostitute, and he does not enjoy the aftermath at all. And he thinks, well, this isn't right. And then I think the other side of the coin, and we're looking at extreme ends here, is that on the one hand, I'm this sinner. On the other hand, I'm this person of the church. And, you know, as we all know, there's a middle ground between the two, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that Stephen doesn't see that he resonates with the idea of, okay, I'm a sinner, that really that fire and brimstone sermon in Portrait of the Artist, but then that's a moral existence that is pretty much unworkable, unsustainable. Mm-hmm. And I think there you have Joyce has had a chip on his shoulder when it comes to religion and the Jesuits. He had one of the greatest educations ever. And so that's really extraordinary. But I think when Stephen's rejecting the church, he ought to reject it for its Jansenist tendencies and embrace for what its teachings are. But I think Joyce sees this opportunity to say, see?
Talking with Dr. Dutton Carney from Hillsdale College about James Joyce and Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. Stephen has a decision at the end of the novel. He leaves his family and friends behind. He goes into exile to become an artist. What do you think Joyce can tell us about the role of the creative person, the artist?
Well, it's really interesting. I don't think that we'd really thought about what it means to be a creative person since the Romantics. There's this romantic vision of someone in an attic and miraculously producing this work of art, or Samuel Taylor Coleridge sitting in a chair and after an opium vision just writes out Kublai Khan. What we know is that it takes an enormous amount of work. But what Stephen wants to do, I think this is, I'm not sure what the origin of this is, but he sees himself as poet and priest, that he is someone who is providing a sacrament, but it's a sacrament of beauty. That the work of art is an outward sign instituted by Joyce that designed to convey beauty. And so in viewing it that way, I think that what we end up having is the elevation of the artist. Mm-hmm. An artist who is as important to culture as, say, a political leader. And so I think that he definitely sees that. And I don't think that he's trying to manipulate things. I think what he's doing is that I'm rejecting these forms, but I'm going to embrace this form.
Dr. Dutton Carney, Associate Professor of English at Hillsdale College, as we talk about James Joyce and Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. Dr. Carney, thanks for joining us here on Bo Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you very much for having me.
That will wrap up this edition of Bo Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to John J. Miller, Director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College, Jeremy Carl, his new book, The Unprotected Class, and Dutton Carney from Hillsdale's English Department. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
As we all get older, the one constant thing is the aggressive, excessive mail and advertising for Medicare, Medicare supplements, and Medicare Advantage. And almost every one of them is a call center with no idea of what you really need. Siskiyou Insurance has an agent that deals with nothing but Medicare issues and can explain the differences clearly between a Medicare supplement and Medicare Advantage. Call Greg Green at Siskiyou Insurance at 530-224-2345 or 1-800-773-2345.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and I'll see you at the range.
When people ask me for a recommendation for a heating or air conditioning company, I always say Alliance Heating and Air. Why? Well, they've been taking care of our HVAC system for 14 years. Professional, friendly, and willing to go to the extra step for their customers. I have found no problem too difficult or too minor for them to repair. I recommend Alliance Heating and Air with no reservations. You can reach them at 530-221-2642 or online at homecomfort.org. And they have 24/7 emergency assistance. Alliance Heating and Air.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world, family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Experience luxurious bliss with Pinnacle Cultivators, Redding's premier licensed legacy cultivator, exclusively at the Queen of Dragons in the city of Shasta Lake. Pinnacle's carefully crafted, expertly curated flower guarantees an exceptional experience with rare genetics and distinctive flavors, freshly packaged daily for a genuine farm-to-table experience. Visit 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard or call 530-276-9771 for delivery and hours of operation. Visit queenofdragons.com or follow us on X at the Queen.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.